They're just identifying it as an effective behavior. In the intervening decades since Erickson's first major papers on the topic, however, neuroscientists have been exploring the physical mechanisms that drive people's improvements on hard tasks. As the journalist Daniel Coyle surveys in his 2009 book, The Talent Code, these scientists increasingly believe the answer includes myelin, a layer of fatty tissue that grows around neurons, acting like an insulator that allows the cells to fire faster and cleaner. To understand the role of myelin in improvement, keep in mind that skills, be they intellectual or physical, eventually reduce down to brain circuits. This new science of performance argues that you get better at a skill as you develop more myelin around the relevant neurons, allowing the corresponding circuit to fire more effortlessly and effectively. To be great at something is to be well myelinated. This understanding is important because it provides a neurological foundation for why deliberate practice works. By focusing intensely on a specific skill, you're forcing the specific relevant circuit to fire again and again in isolation. This repetitive use of a specific circuit triggers cells called oligodendrocytes to begin wrapping layers of myelin around the neurons in the circuits, effectively cementing the skill. The reason, therefore, why it's important to focus intensely on the task at hand while avoiding distraction is because this is the only way to isolate the relevant neural circuit enough to trigger useful myelination. By contrast, if you're trying to learn a complex new skill, say SQL database management, in a state of low concentration, perhaps you also have your Facebook feed open, you're firing too many circuits simultaneously and haphazardly to isolate the group of neurons you actually want to strengthen. In the century that has passed since Antonin Dalmé-Sartillanges first wrote about using the mind like a lens to focus rays of attention, we have advanced from this elevated metaphor to a decidedly less poetic explanation, expressed in terms of oligodendrocyte cells. But this sequence of thinking about thinking points to an inescapable conclusion. To learn hard things quickly, you must focus intensely without distraction. To learn, in other words, is an act of deep work. If you're comfortable going deep, you'll be comfortable mastering the increasingly complex systems and skills needed to thrive in our economy. If you instead remain one of the many for whom depth is uncomfortable and distraction ubiquitous, you shouldn't expect these systems and skills to come easily to you. Deep work helps you produce at an elite level. Adam Grant produces at an elite level. When I met Grant in 2013, he was the youngest professor to be awarded tenure in the history of the Wharton School of Business at Penn. A year later, when I started writing this chapter and was just beginning to think about my own tenure process, the claim was updated. He's now the youngest full professor at Wharton. The reason Grant advanced so quickly in his corner of academia is simple. He produces. In 2012, Grant published 7 articles, all of them in major journals. This is an absurdly high rate for his field, in which professors tend to work alone or in small professional collaborations and do not have large teams of students and postdocs to support their research. In 2013, this count fell to 5. This is still absurdly high, but below his recent standards. He can be excused for this dip, however, because the same year he published a book titled Give and Take, which popularized some of his research on relationships in business. To say that this book was successful is an understatement. It ended up featured on the cover of the New York Times Magazine and went on to become a massive bestseller. When Grant was awarded full professorship in 2014, he'd already written more than 60 peer-reviewed publications in addition to his best-selling book. Soon after meeting Grant, my own academic career on my mind, I couldn't help but ask him about his productivity. Fortunately for me, he was happy to share his thoughts on the subject. It turns out that Grant thinks a lot about the mechanics of producing at an elite level. He sent me, for example, a collection of PowerPoint slides from a workshop he attended with several other professors in his field. The event was focused on data-driven observations about how to produce academic work at an optimum rate. These slides included detailed pie charts of time allocation per season, a flowchart capturing relationship development with co-authors, and a suggested reading list with more than 20 titles. These business professors do not live the cliché of the absent-minded academic lost in books and occasionally stumbling on a big idea. They see productivity as a scientific problem to systematically solve, a goal Adam Grant seems to have achieved. Though Grant's productivity depends on many factors, there's one idea in particular that seems central to his method: the batching of hard but important intellectual work into long, uninterrupted stretches. Grant performs this batching at multiple levels. Within the year, he stacks his teaching into the fall semester, during which he can turn all of his attention to teaching well and being available to his students. This method seems to work, as Grant is currently the highest-rated teacher at Wharton and the winner of multiple teaching awards. By batching his teaching in the fall, Grant can then turn his attention fully to research in the spring and summer and tackle this work with less distraction. Grant also batches his attention on a smaller time scale. Within a semester dedicated to research, he alternates between periods where his door is open to students and colleagues and periods where he isolates himself to focus completely and without distraction on a single research task. He typically divides the writing of a scholarly paper into three discrete tasks: analyzing the data, writing a full draft, and editing the draft into something publishable. During these periods, which can last up to 3 or 4 days, he'll often put an out-of-office autoresponder on his email so correspondents will know not to expect a response. "It sometimes confuses my colleagues," he told me. "They say, 'You're not out of office. I see you in your office right now.'" But to Grant, it's important to enforce strict isolation until he completes the task at hand. My guess is that Adam Grant doesn't work substantially more hours than the average professor at an elite research institution. Generally speaking, this is a group prone to workaholism. But he still manages to produce more than just about anyone else in his field. I argue that his approach to batching helps explain this paradox, in particular by consolidating his work into intense and uninterrupted pulses. He's leveraging the following law of productivity: high-quality work produced equals time spent times intensity of focus. If you believe this formula, then Grant's habits make sense. By maximizing his intensity when he works, he maximizes the results he produces per unit of time spent working. This is not the first time I've encountered this formulaic conception of productivity. It first came to my attention when I was researching my second book, How to Become a Straight-A Student, many years earlier. During that research process, I interviewed around 50 ultra-high-scoring college undergraduates from some of the country's most competitive schools. Something I noticed in these interviews is that the very best students often studied less than the group of students right below them on the GPA rankings. One of the explanations for this phenomenon turned out to be the formula detailed earlier. The best students understood the role intensity plays in productivity, and therefore went out of their way to maximize their concentration, radically reducing the time required to prepare for tests or write papers, without diminishing the quality of their results. The example of Adam Grant implies that this intensity formula applies beyond just undergraduate GPA, and is also relevant to other cognitively demanding tasks. But why would this be? An interesting explanation comes from Sophie Leroy, a business professor at the University of Minnesota. In a 2009 paper titled, intriguingly, Why Is It So Hard to Do My Work?, Leroy introduced an effect she called attention residue. In the introduction to this paper, she noted that other researchers have studied the effect of multitasking, trying to accomplish multiple tasks simultaneously, on performance, but that in the modern knowledge work office, once you got to a high enough level, it was more common to find people working on multiple projects sequentially. Going from one meeting to the next, starting to work on one project, and soon after having to transition to another is just part of life in organizations, Leroy explains. The problem this research identifies with this work strategy is that when you switch from some task A to another task B, your attention doesn't immediately follow. A residue of your attention remains stuck thinking about the original task. This residue gets especially thick if your work on task A was unbounded and of low intensity before you switched. But even if you finish task A before moving on, your attention remains divided for a while. Leroy studied the effect of this attention residue on performance by forcing task switches in the laboratory. In one such experiment, for example, she started her subjects working on a set of word puzzles. In one of the trials, she would interrupt them and tell them that they needed to move on to a new and challenging task, in this case, reading resumes and making hypothetical hiring decisions. In other trials, she let the subjects finish the puzzles before giving them the next task. In between puzzling and hiring, she would deploy a quick lexical decision game to quantify the amount of residue left from the first task. The results from this and her similar experiments were clear. People experiencing attention residue after switching tasks are likely to demonstrate poor performance on that next task. And the more intense the residue, the worse the performance. The concept of attention residue helps explain why the intensity formula is true, and therefore helps explain Grant's productivity. By working on a single hard task for a long time without switching, Grant minimizes the negative impact of attention residue from his other obligations, allowing him to maximize performance on this one task. When Grant is working for days in isolation on a paper, in other words, he's doing so at a higher level of effectiveness than the standard professor following a more distracted strategy in which the work is repeatedly interrupted by residue-slathering interruptions. Even if you're unable to fully replicate Grant's extreme isolation, we'll tackle different strategies for scheduling depth in part two, the attention residue concept is still telling, because it implies that the common habit of working in a state of semi-distraction is potentially devastating to your performance. It might seem harmless to take a quick glance at your inbox every 10 minutes or so. Indeed, many justify this behavior as better than the old practice of leaving an inbox open on the screen at all times, a straw man habit that few follow anymore. But Leroy teaches us that this is not, in fact, much of an improvement. That quick check introduces a new target for your attention. Even worse, by seeing messages that you cannot deal with at the moment, which is almost always the case, you'll be forced to turn back to the primary task with a secondary task left unfinished. The attention residue left by such unresolved switches dampens your performance. When we step back from these individual observations, we see a clear argument form. To produce at your peak level, you need to work for extended periods with full concentration on a single task free from distraction. Put another way, the type of work that optimizes your performance is deep work. If you're not comfortable going deep for extended periods of time, it'll be difficult to get your performance to the peak levels of quality and quantity increasingly necessary to thrive professionally. Unless your talent and skills absolutely dwarf those of your competition, the deep workers among them will outproduce you. What about Jack Dorsey? I've now made my argument for why deep work supports abilities that are becoming increasingly important in our economy. Before we accept this conclusion, however, we must face a type of question that often arises when I discuss this topic. What about Jack Dorsey? Jack Dorsey helped found Twitter. After stepping down as CEO, he then launched the payment processing company Square. To quote a Forbes profile, he is a disruptor on a massive scale and a repeat offender. He is also someone who does not spend a lot of time in a state of deep work. Dorsey doesn't have the luxury of long periods of uninterrupted thinking, because at the time when the Forbes profile was written, he maintained management duties at both Twitter, where he remained chairman, and Square, leading to a tightly calibrated schedule that ensures that the companies have a predictable weekly cadence, and that also ensures that Dorsey's time and attention are severely fractured. Dorsey reports, for example, that he ends the average day with 30 to 40 sets of meeting notes that he reviews and filters at night. In the small spaces between all these meetings, he believes in serendipitous availability. I do a lot of my work at stand-up tables, which anyone can come up to, Dorsey said. I get to hear all these conversations around the company. This style of work is not deep. To use a term from our previous section, Dorsey's attention residue is likely slathered on thick as he darts from one meeting to another, letting people interrupt him freely in the brief interludes in between. And yet, we cannot say that Dorsey's work is shallow, because shallow work, as defined in the introduction, is low value and easily replicable, while what Jack Dorsey does is incredibly valuable and highly rewarded in our economy. As of this writing, he was among the top 1,000 richest people in the world, with a net worth over $1.1 billion. Jack Dorsey is important to our discussion because he's an exemplar of a group we cannot ignore. Individuals who thrive without depth. When I titled the motivating question of this section, "What about Jack Dorsey?" I was providing a specific example of a more general query. If deep work is so important, why are there distracted people who do well? To conclude this chapter, I want to address this question so it doesn't nag at your attention as we dive deeper into the topic of depth in the sections ahead. To start, we must first note that Jack Dorsey is a high-level executive of a large company, two companies in fact. Individuals with such positions play a major role in the category of those who thrive without depth, because the lifestyle of such executives is famously and unavoidably distracted. Here's Carrie Trainor, CEO of Vimeo, trying to answer the question of how long he can go without email. I can go a good solid Saturday without, most of the daytime without it. I mean, I'll check it, but I won't necessarily respond. At the same time, of course, these executives are better compensated and more important in the American economy today than in any other time in history. Jack Dorsey's success without depth is common at this elite level of management. Once we've stipulated this reality, we must then step back to remind ourselves that it doesn't undermine the general value of depth. Why? Because the necessity of distraction in these executives' work lives is highly specific to their particular jobs. A good chief executive is essentially a hard-to-automate decision engine, not unlike IBM's Jeopardy-playing Watson system. They have built up a hard-won repository of experience and have honed and proved an instinct for their market. They're then presented inputs throughout the day, in the form of emails, meetings, site visits, and the like, that they must process and act on. To ask a CEO to spend 4 hours thinking deeply about a single problem is a waste of what makes him or her valuable. It's better to hire 3 smart subordinates to think deeply about the problem and then bring their solutions to the executive for a final decision. This specificity is important because it tells us that if you're a high-level executive at a major company, you probably don't need the advice in the sections that follow. On the other hand, it also tells us that you cannot extrapolate the approach of these executives to other jobs. The fact that Dorsey encourages interruption, or Carrie Trainor checks his email constantly doesn't mean that you'll share their success if you follow suit. Their behaviors are characteristic of their specific roles as corporate officers. This rule of specificity should be applied to similar counterexamples that come to mind while listening to the rest of this book. There are, we must continually remember, certain corners of our economy where depth is not valued. In addition to executives, we can also include, for example, certain types of salesmen and lobbyists for whom constant connection is their most valued currency. There are even those who manage to grind out distracted success in fields where depth would help. But at the same time, don't be too hasty to label your job as necessarily non-deep. Just because your current habits make deep work difficult doesn't mean that this lack of depth is fundamental to doing your job well. In the next chapter, for example, I tell the story of a group of high-powered management consultants who were convinced that constant email connectivity was necessary for them to service their clients. When a Harvard professor forced them to disconnect more regularly as part of a research study, they found, to their surprise, that this connectivity didn't matter nearly as much as they had assumed. The clients didn't really need to reach them at all times, and their performance as consultants improved once their attention became less fractured. Similarly, several managers I know tried to convince me that they're most valuable when they're able to respond quickly to their team's problems, preventing project logjams. They see their role as enabling others' productivity, not necessarily protecting their own. Follow-up discussions, however, soon uncovered that this goal didn't really require attention-fracturing connectivity. Indeed, many software companies now deploy the Scrum project management methodology, which replaces a lot of this ad hoc messaging with regular, highly structured, and ruthlessly efficient status meetings, often held standing up to minimize the urge to bloviate. This approach frees up more managerial time for thinking deeply about the problems their teams are tackling, often improving the overall value of what they produce. Put another way, deep work is not the only skill valuable in our economy, and it's possible to do well without fostering this ability. But the niches where this is advisable are increasingly rare. Unless you have strong evidence that distraction is important for your specific profession, you're best served, for the reasons argued earlier in this chapter, by giving serious consideration to depth. Chapter 2. Deep work is rare. In 2012, Facebook unveiled the plans for a new headquarters designed by Frank Gehry. At the center of this new building is what CEO Mark Zuckerberg called the largest open floor plan in the world. More than 3,000 employees will work on movable furniture spread over a 10-acre expanse. Facebook, of course, is not the only Silicon Valley heavyweight to embrace the open office concept. When Jack Dorsey, whom we met at the end of the last chapter, bought the old San Francisco Chronicle building to house Square, he configured the space so that his developers work in common spaces on long, shared desks. We encourage people to stay out in the open because we believe in serendipity and people walking by each other teaching new things, Dorsey explained. Another big business trend in recent years is the rise of instant messaging. A Times article notes that this technology is no longer the province of chatty teenagers and is now helping companies benefit from new productivity gains and improvements in customer response time. A senior project manager at IBM boasts, "We send 2.5 million IMs within IBM each day." One of the more successful recent entrants into the business IM space is Hall, a Silicon Valley startup that helps employees move beyond just chat and engage in real-time collaboration. A San Francisco-based developer I know described to me what it was like to work in a company that uses Hall. The most efficient employees, he explained, set up their text editor to flash an alert on their screen when a new question or comment is posted to the company's Hall account. They can then, with a sequence of practiced keystrokes, jump over to Hall, type in their thoughts, and then jump back to their coding with barely a pause. My friends seemed impressed when describing their speed. A third trend is the push for content producers of all types to maintain a social media presence. The New York Times, a bastion of old-world media values, now encourages its employees to tweet, a hint taken by the more than 800 writers, editors, and photographers for the paper who now maintain a Twitter account. This is not outlier behavior. It's instead the new normal. When the novelist Jonathan Franzen wrote a piece for The Guardian calling Twitter a coercive development in the literary world, he was widely ridiculed as out of touch. The online magazine Slate called Franzen's complaints a lonely war on the internet. And fellow novelist Jennifer Weiner wrote a response in The New Republic in which she argued Franzen's a category of one, a lonely voice issuing ex cathedra edicts that can only apply to himself. The sarcastic hashtag Jonathan Franzen hates soon became a fad. I mention these three business trends because they highlight a paradox. In the last chapter, I argued that deep work is more valuable than ever before in our shifting economy. If this is true, however, you would expect to see this skill promoted not just by ambitious individuals, but also by organizations hoping to get the most out of their employees. As the examples provided emphasize, this is not happening. Many other ideas are being prioritized as more important than deep work in the business world, including, as we just encountered, serendipitous collaboration, rapid communication, and an active presence on social media. It's bad enough that so many trends are prioritized ahead of deep work, but to add insult to injury, many of these trends actively decrease one's ability to go deep. Open offices, for example, might create more opportunities for collaboration, but they do so at the cost of massive distraction. To quote the results of experiments conducted for a British TV special titled The Secret Life of Office Buildings. If you were just getting into some work and a phone goes off in the background, it ruins what you were concentrating on, said the neuroscientist who ran the experiments for the show. Even though you were not aware at the time, the brain responds to distractions. Similar issues apply to the rise of real-time messaging. Email inboxes, in theory, can distract you only when you choose to open them, whereas instant messenger systems are meant to be always active, magnifying the impact of interruption. Gloria Mark, a professor of informatics at the University of California, Irvine, is an expert on the science of attention fragmentation. In a well-cited study, Mark and her co-authors observed knowledge workers in real offices and found that an interruption, even if short, delays the total time required to complete a task by a significant fraction. This was reported by subjects as being very detrimental, she summarized with typical academic understatement. Forcing content producers onto social media also has negative effects on the ability to go deep. Serious journalists, for example, need to focus on doing serious journalism, diving into complicated sources, pulling out connective threads, crafting persuasive prose. So, to ask them to interrupt this deep thinking throughout the day to participate in the frothy back and forth of online tittering seems irrelevant and somewhat demeaning at best, and devastatingly distracting at worst. The respected New Yorker staff writer, George Packer, captured this fear well in an essay about why he does not tweet. Twitter is crack for media addicts. It scares me, not because I'm morally superior to it, but because I don't think I could handle it. I'm afraid I'd end up letting my son go hungry. Tellingly, when he wrote that essay, Packer was busy writing his book, The Unwinding, which came out soon after and promptly won the National Book Award, despite, or perhaps aided by, his lack of social media use. To summarize, big trends in business today actively decrease people's ability to perform deep work, even though the benefits promised by these trends, e.g. increased serendipity, faster responses to requests, and more exposure, are arguably dwarfed by the benefits that flow from a commitment to deep work, e.g. the ability to learn hard things fast and produce at an elite level. The goal of this chapter is to explain this paradox. The rareness of deep work, I'll argue, is not due to some fundamental weakness of the habit. When we look closer at why we embrace distraction in the workplace, we'll find the reasons are more arbitrary than we might expect. Based on flawed thinking combined with the ambiguity and confusion that often define knowledge work. My objective is to convince you that although our current embrace of distraction is a real phenomenon, it's built on an unstable foundation and can be easily dismissed once you decide to cultivate a deep work ethic. The Metric Black Hole. In the fall of 2012, Tom Cochran, the chief technology officer of Atlantic Media, became alarmed at how much time he seemed to spend on email. So, like any good techie, he decided to quantify this unease. Observing his own behavior, he measured that in a single week, he received 511 email messages and sent 284. This averaged to around 160 emails per day over a 5-day work week. Calculating further, Cochran noted that even if he managed to spend only 30 seconds per message on average, this still added up to almost an hour and a half per day dedicated to moving information around like a human network router. This seemed like a lot of time spent on something that wasn't a primary piece of his job description. As Cochran recalls in a blog post he wrote about his experiment for the Harvard Business Review, these simple statistics got him thinking about the rest of his company. Just how much time were employees of Atlantic Media spending moving around information instead of focusing on the specialized tasks they were hired to perform? Determined to answer this question, Cochran gathered company-wide statistics on emails sent per day and the average number of words per email. He then combined these numbers with the employees' average typing speed, reading speed, and salary. The result? He discovered that Atlantic Media was spending well over $1 million a year to pay people to process emails, with every message sent or received tapping the company for around 95 cents of labor costs. A free and frictionless method of communication, Cochran summarized, had soft costs equivalent to procuring a small company Learjet. Tom Cochran's experiment yielded an interesting result about the literal cost of a seemingly harmless behavior. But the real importance of this story is the experiment itself, and in particular, its complexity. It turns out to be really difficult to answer a simple question such as, what's the impact of our current email habits on the bottom line? Cochran had to conduct a company-wide survey and gather statistics from the IT infrastructure. He also had to pull together salary data and information on typing and reading speed and run the whole thing through a statistical model to spit out his final result. And even then, the outcome is fungible, as it's not able to separate out, for example, how much value was produced by this frequent, expensive email use to offset some of its cost. This example generalizes to most behaviors that potentially impede or improve deep work. Even though we abstractly accept that distraction has costs and depth has value, these impacts, as Tom Cochran discovered, are difficult to measure. This isn't a trait unique to habits related to distraction and depth. Generally speaking, as knowledge work makes more complex demands of the labor force, it becomes harder to measure the value of an individual's efforts. The French economist Thomas Piketty made this point explicit in his study of the extreme growth of executive salaries. The enabling assumption driving his argument is that it is objectively difficult to measure individual contributions to a firm's output. In the absence of such measures, irrational outcomes such as executive salaries way out of proportion to the executive's marginal productivity can occur. Even though some details of Piketty's theory are controversial, the underlying assumption that it's increasingly difficult to measure individuals' contributions is generally considered, to quote one of his critics, undoubtedly true. We should not, therefore, expect the bottom-line impact of depth-destroying behaviors to be easily detected. As Tom Cochran discovered, such metrics fall into an opaque region resistant to easy measurement, a region I call the metric black hole. Of course, just because it's hard to measure metrics related to deep work doesn't automatically lead to the conclusion that businesses will dismiss it. We have many examples of behaviors for which it's hard to measure their bottom-line impact, but that nevertheless flourish in our business culture. Think, for example, of the three trends that opened this chapter, or the outsized executive salaries that puzzled Thomas Piketty. But without clear metrics to support it, any business behavior is vulnerable to unstable whim and shifting forces, and in this volatile scrum, deep work has fared particularly poorly. The reality of this metric black hole is the backdrop for the arguments that follow in this chapter. In these upcoming sections, I'll describe various mindsets and biases that have pushed business away from deep work and toward more distracting alternatives. None of these behaviors would survive long if it was clear that they were hurting the bottom line. But the metric black hole prevents this clarity and allows the shift toward distraction we increasingly encounter in the professional world. The principle of least resistance. When it comes to distracting behaviors embraced in the workplace, we must give a position of dominance to the now ubiquitous culture of connectivity, where one is expected to read and respond to emails and related communication quickly. In researching this topic, Harvard Business School professor Leslie Perlow found that the professionals she surveyed spent around 20 to 25 hours a week outside the office monitoring email, believing it important to answer any email, internal or external, within an hour of its arrival. You might argue, as many do, that this behavior is necessary in many fast-paced businesses. But here's where things get interesting. Perlow tested this claim. In more detail, she convinced executives at the Boston Consulting Group, a high-pressure management consulting firm with an ingrained culture of connectivity, to let her fiddle with the work habits of one of their teams. She wanted to test a simple question. Does it really help your work to be constantly connected? To do so, she did something extreme. She forced each member of the team to take one day out of the work week completely off. No connectivity to anyone inside or outside the company. At first, the team resisted the experiment, she recalled about one of the trials. The partner in charge, who had been very supportive of the basic idea, was suddenly nervous about having to tell her client that each member of her team would be off one day a week. The consultants were equally nervous and worried that they were putting their careers in jeopardy. But the team didn't lose their clients, and its members did not lose their jobs. Instead, the consultants found more enjoyment in their work, better communication among themselves, more learning, as we might have predicted given the connection between depth and skill development highlighted in the last chapter, and perhaps most important, a better product delivered to the client. This motivates an interesting question. Why do so many follow the lead of the Boston Consulting Group and foster a culture of connectivity even though it's likely, as Perlow found in her study, that it hurts employees' well-being and productivity and probably doesn't help the bottom line? I think the answer can be found in the following reality of workplace behavior. The principle of least resistance. In a business setting, without clear feedback on the impact of various behaviors to the bottom line, we will tend toward behaviors that are easiest in the moment. To return to our question about why cultures of connectivity persist, the answer, according to our principle, is because it's easier. There are at least two big reasons why this is true. The first concerns responsiveness to your needs. If you work in an environment where you can get an answer to a question or a specific piece of information immediately when the need arises, this makes your life easier, at least in the moment. If you couldn't count on this quick response time, you'd instead have to do more advanced planning for your work, be more organized, and be prepared to put things aside for a while and turn your attention elsewhere while waiting for what you requested. All of this would make the day-to-day of your working life harder, even if it produced more satisfaction and a better outcome in the long term. The rise of professional instant messaging mentioned earlier in this chapter can be seen as this mindset pushed toward an extreme. If receiving an email reply within an hour makes your day easier, then getting an answer via instant message in under a minute would improve this gain by an order of magnitude. The second reason that a culture of connectivity makes life easier is that it creates an environment where it becomes acceptable to run your day out of your inbox, responding to the latest missive with alacrity while others pile up behind it, all the while feeling satisfyingly productive. More on this soon. If email were to move to the periphery of your workday, you'd be required to deploy a more thoughtful approach to figuring out what you should be working on and for how long. This type of planning is hard. Consider, for example, David Allen's Getting Things Done task management methodology, which is a well-respected system for intelligently managing competing workplace obligations. This system proposes a 15-element flowchart for making a decision on what to do next. It's significantly easier to simply chime in on the latest CC'd email thread. I'm picking on constant connectivity as a case study in this discussion, but it's just one of many examples of business behaviors that are antithetical to depth and likely reducing the bottom-line value produced by the company that nonetheless thrives because, in the absence of metrics, most people fall back on what's easiest. To name another example, consider the common practice of setting up regularly occurring meetings for projects. These meetings tend to pile up and fracture schedules to the point where sustained focus during the day becomes impossible. Why do they persist? They're easier. For many, these standing meetings become a simple but blunt form of personal organization. Instead of trying to manage their time and obligations themselves, they let the impending meeting each week force them to take some action on a given project, and more generally, provide a highly visible simulacrum of progress. Also, consider the frustratingly common practice of forwarding an email to one or more colleagues, labeled with a short, open-ended interrogative such as, "Thoughts?" These emails take the sender only a handful of seconds to write, but can command many minutes, if not hours, in some cases, of time and attention from their recipients to work toward a coherent response. A little more care in crafting the message by the sender could reduce the overall time spent by all parties by a significant fraction. So why are these easily avoidable and time-sucking emails so common? From the sender's perspective, they're easier. It's a way to clear something out of their inbox, at least temporarily, with a minimum amount of energy invested. The principle of least resistance, protected from scrutiny by the metric black hole, supports work cultures that save us from the short-term discomfort of concentration and planning at the expense of long-term satisfaction and the production of real value. By doing so, this principle drives us toward shallow work in an economy that increasingly rewards depth. It's not, however, the only trend that leverages the metric black hole to reduce depth. We must also consider the always present and always vexing demand toward productivity, the topic we'll turn our attention to next. Busyness as a proxy for productivity. There are a lot of things difficult about being a professor at a research-oriented university. But one benefit that this profession enjoys is clarity. How well or how poorly you're doing as an academic researcher can be boiled down to a simple question. Are you publishing important papers? The answer to this question can even be quantified as a single number, such as the H index, a formula named for its inventor, George Hirsch, that processes your publication and citation counts into a single value that approximates your impact on your field. In computer science, for example, an H index score above 40 is difficult to achieve, and once reached, is considered the mark of a strong, long-term career. On the other hand, if your H index is in single digits when your case goes up for tenure review, you're probably in trouble. Google Scholar, a tool popular among academics for finding research papers, even calculates your H index automatically, so you can be reminded multiple times per week precisely where you stand. In case you're wondering, as of the morning when I'm writing this chapter, I'm a 21. This clarity simplifies decisions about what work habits a professor adopts or abandons. Here, for example, is the late Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman explaining in an interview one of his less orthodox productivity strategies. To do real good physics work, you need absolute solid lengths of time. It needs a lot of concentration. If you have a job administrating anything, you don't have the time. So I have invented another myth for myself, that I'm irresponsible. I'm actively irresponsible. I tell everyone I don't do anything. If anyone asks me to be on a committee for admissions, no, I tell them, I'm irresponsible. Feynman was adamant in avoiding administrative duties because he knew they would only decrease his ability to do the one thing that mattered most in his professional life, to do real good physics work. Feynman, we can assume, was probably bad at responding to emails and would likely switch universities if you had tried to move him into an open office or demand that he tweet. Clarity about what matters provides clarity about what does not. I mention the example of professors because they're somewhat exceptional among knowledge workers, most of whom don't share this transparency regarding how well they're doing their job. Here's the social critic Matthew Crawford's description of this uncertainty. Managers themselves inhabit a bewildering psychic landscape and are made anxious by the vague imperatives that they must answer to. Though Crawford was speaking specifically to the plight of the knowledge work middle manager, the bewildering psychic landscape he references applies to many positions in this sector. As Crawford describes in his 2009 Ode to the Trades, Shop Class as Soulcraft, he quit his job as a Washington, D.C. think tank director to open a motorcycle repair shop exactly to escape this bewilderment. The feeling of taking a broken machine, struggling with it, then eventually enjoying a tangible indication that he had succeeded, the bike driving out of the shop under its own power, provides a concrete sense of accomplishment he struggled to replicate when his day revolved vaguely around reports and communication strategies. A similar reality creates problems for many knowledge workers. They want to prove that they're productive members of the team and are earning their keep, but they're not entirely clear what this goal constitutes. They have no rising H index or rack of repaired motorcycles to point to as evidence of their worth. To overcome this gap, many seem to be turning back to the last time when productivity was more universally observable, the industrial age. To understand this claim, recall that with the rise of assembly lines came the rise of the efficiency movement, identified with its founder, Frederick Taylor, who would famously stand with a stopwatch monitoring the efficiency of worker movements, looking for ways to increase the speed at which they accomplish their tasks. In Taylor's era, productivity was unambiguous, widgets created per unit of time. It seems that in today's business landscape, many knowledge workers, bereft of other ideas, are turning toward this old definition of productivity in trying to solidify their value in the otherwise bewildering landscape of their professional lives. David Allen, for example, even uses the specific phrase cranking widgets to describe a productive workflow. Knowledge workers, I'm arguing, are tending toward increasingly visible busyness because they lack a better way to demonstrate their value. Let's give this tendency a name. Busyness as proxy for productivity. In the absence of clear indicators of what it means to be productive and valuable in their jobs, many knowledge workers turn back toward an industrial indicator of productivity, doing lots of stuff in a visible manner. This mindset provides another explanation for the popularity of many depth-destroying behaviors. If you send and answer emails at all hours, if you schedule and attend meetings constantly, if you weigh in on instant message systems like Hall within seconds when someone poses a new question, or if you roam your open office bouncing ideas off all whom you encounter, all of these behaviors make you seem busy in a public manner. If you're using busyness as a proxy for productivity, then these behaviors can seem crucial for convincing yourself and others that you're doing your job well. This mindset is not necessarily irrational. For some, their jobs really do depend on such behavior. In 2013, for example, Yahoo's new CEO, Marissa Mayer, banned employees from working at home. She made this decision after checking the server logs for the virtual private network that Yahoo employees use to remotely log into company servers. Mayer was upset because the employees working from home didn't sign in enough throughout the day. She was, in some sense, punishing her employees for not spending more time checking email, one of the primary reasons to log into the servers. "If you're not visibly busy," she signaled, "I'll assume you're not productive." Viewed objectively, however, this concept is anachronistic. Knowledge work is not an assembly line, and extracting value from information is an activity that's often at odds with busyness, not supported by it. Remember, for example, Adam Grant, the academic from our last chapter, who became the youngest full professor at Wharton by repeatedly shutting himself off from the outside world to concentrate on writing. Such behavior is the opposite of being publicly busy. If Grant worked for Yahoo, Marissa Mayer might have fired him. But this deep strategy turned out to produce a massive amount of value. We could, of course, eliminate this anachronistic commitment to busyness if we could easily demonstrate its negative impact on the bottom line. But the metric black hole enters the scene at this point and prevents such clarity. This potent mixture of job ambiguity and lack of metrics to measure the effectiveness of different strategies allows behavior that can seem ridiculous when viewed objectively to thrive in the increasingly bewildering psychic landscape of our daily work. As we'll see next, however, even those who have a clear understanding of what it means to succeed in their knowledge work job can still be lured away from depth. All it takes is an ideology seductive enough to convince you to discard common sense. The cult of the Internet. Consider Alyssa Rubin. She's the New York Times bureau chief in Paris. Before that, she was the bureau chief in Kabul, Afghanistan, where she reported from the front lines on the post-war reconstruction. Around the time I was writing this chapter, she was publishing a series of hard-hitting articles that looked at the French government's complicity in the Rwandan genocide. Rubin, in other words, is a serious journalist who is good at her craft. She also, at what I can only assume is the persistent urging of her employer, tweets. Rubin's Twitter profile reveals a steady and somewhat desultory string of missives, one every 2 to 4 days, as if Rubin receives a regular notice from the Times social media desk, a real thing, reminding her to appease her followers. With few exceptions, the tweets simply mention an article she recently read and liked. Rubin is a reporter, not a media personality. Her value to her paper is her ability to cultivate important sources, pull together facts, and write articles that make a splash. It's the Alyssa Rubens of the world who provide the Times with its reputation, and it's this reputation that provides the foundation for the paper's commercial success in an age of ubiquitous and addictive clickbait. So why is Alyssa Rubin urged to regularly interrupt this necessarily deep work to provide, for free, shallow content to a service run by an unrelated media company based out of Silicon Valley? And perhaps even more important, why does this behavior seem so normal to most people? If we can answer these questions, we'll better understand the final trend I want to discuss relevant to the question of why deep work has become so paradoxically rare. A foundation for our answer can be found in a warning provided by the late communication theorist and New York University professor Neil Postman. Writing in the early 1990s, as the personal computer revolution first accelerated, Postman argued that our society was sliding into a troubling relationship with technology. We were, he noted, no longer discussing the trade-offs surrounding new technologies, balancing the new efficiencies against the new problems introduced. If it's high tech, we began to instead assume, then it's good. Case closed. He called such a culture a technopoly, and he didn't mince words in warning against it. Technopoly eliminates alternatives to itself in precisely the way Aldous Huxley outlined in Brave New World, he argued in his 1993 book on the topic. It does not make them illegal. It does not make them immoral. It does not even make them unpopular. It makes them invisible, and therefore irrelevant. Postman died in 2003, but if he were alive today, he would likely express amazement about how quickly his fears from the 1990s came to fruition, a slide driven by the unforeseen and sudden rise of the Internet. Fortunately, Postman has an intellectual heir to continue this argument in the Internet age, the hyper-citational social critic Evgeny Morozov. In his 2013 book, To Save Everything, Click Here, Morozov attempts to pull back the curtains on our technopolic obsession with the Internet, a term he purposefully places in scare quotes to emphasize its role as an ideology, saying it's this propensity to view the Internet as a source of wisdom and policy advice that transforms it from a fairly uninteresting set of cables and network routers into a seductive and exciting ideology. Perhaps today's Uber ideology. In Morozov's critique, we've made the Internet synonymous with the revolutionary future of business and government. To make your company more like the Internet is to be with the times, and to ignore these trends is to be the proverbial buggy whip maker in an automotive age. We no longer see Internet tools as products released by for-profit companies, funded by investors hoping to make a return, and run by 20-somethings who are often making things up as they go along. We're instead quick to idolize these digital doodads as a signifier of progress and a harbinger of a, dare I say, brave, new world. This Internet centrism, to steal another Morozov term, is what technopoly looks like today. It's important that we recognize this reality because it explains the question that opened this section. The New York Times maintains a social media desk and pressures its writers, like Alyssa Rubin, toward distracting behavior, because in an Internet-centric technopoly, such behavior is not up for discussion. The alternative to not embrace all things Internet is, as Postman would say, invisible and therefore irrelevant. This invisibility explains the uproar mentioned earlier that arose when Jonathan Franzen dared suggest that novelists shouldn't tweet. It riled people, not because they're well-versed in book marketing and disagreed with Franzen's conclusion, but because it surprised them that anyone serious would suggest the irrelevance of social media. In an Internet-centric technopoly, such a statement is the equivalent of a flag burning, desecration, not debate. Perhaps the near-universal reach of this mindset is best captured in an experience I had recently on my commute to the Georgetown campus where I work. Waiting for the light to change so I could cross Connecticut Avenue, I idled behind a truck from a refrigerated supply chain logistics company. Refrigerated shipping is a complex, competitive business that requires equal skill managing trade unions and route scheduling.